Land use. I'd like to thank our committee members for being here this evening. Nobody likes to do overtime, especially with all of our schedules, but this will be the week from you know where for all of this. This committee had 121 bills to be heard, basically in five meetings. So it's been a heck of a battle, and will continue tonight. We have a Representative Smith with us, so we're going to kind of move around on the agenda just a little bit and open up with House Bill 3245 to allow Representative Greg Smith. So we will open a work session on House Bill 3245. By the way, committee, I might also, on those bills we tap-tapped last week, we did that merely to preserve the bill. We did not do that with any kind of design in mind to move something forward without having testimony on it. And I assure this committee we will hear testimony, and if there are any bills that you would like additional testimony on, you let the chair know. It is not our intention to backdoor anything here.
Chair, would you mind if Mr. Minor sat with me to provide technical assistance?
Well, a technical assistant is always necessary, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Girard, Vice Chair Richardson, Vice Chair Zoner. For the record, my name is Representative Greg Smith. I represent District 57, which includes Union, Wallowa, Umatilla, and Morrow counties.
Representative, before you begin, I'll have our administrator refresh the committee on the bill and the fact that I think we have a dash 2 amendment to the bill.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're looking at House Bill 3245 that limits requirements that cities and counties approve an application for a subdivision for a manufactured dwelling park or mobile home park to counties with a population of 100,000 or more in cities located within such counties. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are actually two amendments before you. The dash one amendment requires a park to have, on the date of application, paved streets, curbs, and sidewalks meeting standards set in the Portland metropolitan area, or consistent, I should say, with the Portland metropolitan area. The dash 2 actually replaces the original amendment and allows conversion of manufactured dwelling and mobile home parks, Mr. Chair.
So dash 2 also includes one, or we just have one amendment to just the dash 2?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The dash 2 is different, much different than the dash 1s. In the dash 1s, you're inserting, after a line 3 on the original bill, in the dash 2s, you are deleting lines 4 through 20, which is the entire bill, and you're replacing it with the dash 2 amendments if the committee was to adopt that. So they're two much different amendments.
Representative, if you would, tell us about the bill as it now exists with the dash 2s, please.
Thank you, Mr. Girard, members of the committee. Just as a little bit of background, about 4 months ago I was meeting with the city manager in the city of Boardman, and we were talking about some subdivisions that resided within the city limits, and he was expressing some concern to me. And not being a technical expert on the details of a subdivision or the details of manufactured dwelling parks or the details on mobile home parks, I introduced House Bill 3245 as to what is truly a very blunt instrument to solve a problem. And I'm pleased to say that as soon as it was introduced, Mr. Minor and Mr. Brenneman came to me and said, we think that this is a bill that could be modified and amended to make it work. And I've had a chance to meet with both these gentlemen. And as part of this work, we bring forward to you the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3245. And if it would please the chair, I would turn to Mr. Minor to explain the technical details of the amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Minor here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association, as well as a number of folks in our work group speaking in support of the dash 2 amendment. group consisted of representatives from the Real Estate Commissioner's Office, park owners, consumers, representatives from some cities, and I believe the American Council Association. Last legislative bill was passed that allowed an existing mobile home park to be converted to a subdivision and streamlined the approval process so that it did not have to go back through zoning approval. And the goal of that was to allow the park owners to sell the park to the consumers.
John, do you remember the House bill number on that?
Mr. Chair, do you have this?
House Bill 3686, if my memory serves me. There are some problems in that bill. It was, again, the purpose of the bill, as introduced by the Department of Justice, was to facilitate the sale of the park to the residents of the park. There are some owners, at least one, has allegedly, at least, attempted to use this process to remove the consumers from the park and uses a streamlined process to create a site-built or stick-built subdivision, which clearly was contrary to the intent. There's also been some concerns raised by cities, City Boardman being one, as to is there an assurance that the facilities in the park, the infrastructure, the water, the sewer, the roads, will be maintained. Our goal in the Dash 2 amendment was to create a process to ensure that will be maintained by the new owners and that responsibility not fall to the city. There's probably still a little bit of polishing that could be done to this, but it's in a substantial form that folks can support, and we would hope they would pass from this committee with the Dash 2 amendment.
Are there any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Brock.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 3245? Linda? Good evening.
Hi, good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Please excuse my voice. For the record, Linda Ledwick, Legal Oregon Cities. League of Oregon Cities does have some concerns about polishing up this bill. While we do agree with the major tenets of it, there are some issues about infrastructure and the Homeowners Association that we would like to see further work. The bill does make an improvement over the current legislation, and it just needs to finish a couple of those gaps. If the chair is inclined to turn out the bill today, this evening, we've been told by the proponents of the bill that we can take care of the amendments in the Senate side.
Thank you.
Just wanted to put that on the record.
We appreciate that very much. Any questions? Okay, seeing none, Representative Zoner.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3245.
Representative Zoner moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3245. Any discussion? Seeing none, those call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Greenland.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Excuse me.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative
Zoner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Gillard.
Chair votes aye. The Dash 2 amendments are accepted to House Bill 3245. Representative Zoner.
I would like to move House Bill 3245 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Zoner moves House Bill 3245 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Excused.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Zoner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Gerard.
Chair votes aye. Representative Smith, would you like to carry this bill? Representative Greg Smith will carry House Bill 3245 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. As amended. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 3245. And we will open the work session on House Bill 2912. Did I say work session?
Yes, sir. You remember.
Anyone who wishes to speak on House Bill 2912? Please come forward.
Liz Frankel for the League of Women Voters. In brief, because you're in a hurry, I didn't get to testify at the first hearing, but I do want to thank you for this moment. The League feels very strongly about this bill, that the way in which it's constructed is the legislature dealing with how you're going to restructure land use in Oregon. The way in which it was land use was originally begun was from bottom up, not from top down. We feel rather strongly about this. We think that the buy-in from the public is crucial, and you get that by beginning at the bottom. And if you, this is going to take some money, whatever way you do it, we would suggest that the money be used, given to DLCD with a direction to go out to the public and find out what they think works, doesn't work, and what changes should be evolved. The League does not oppose changes, but we do think that if you're going to begin this process, it will work best for Oregon to begin at the bottom. And thank you very much. I have included a copy of the League's update on land use for your committee.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Committee, we do have dash two amendments to this bill. Ray, you want to catch the committee up to date on what we're looking at with this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill was heard on the 3rd. What the committee had discussed was the land use planning system, Senate Bill 100 for 1973 land use program objectives, goals, and guidelines in both the Land Conservation Development Commission and Department of Land Conservation and Development. The administrator has actually three amendments in front of him. One adds one member to the Oregon Commission on Land Use Reform, increases the governor's appointment authority by one person. The dash two adds one person representing a metropolitan service district and revises the mission of the commission. And then there's also a dash three that splits things into agriculture and timber industry.
Dash three?
Only thing we've seen were dash twos. And I think, Ray, most of those were done in the two amendments, dash one and two, I think covered everything you just mentioned. Oh, you did find a dash three.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
We'll pass them out directly.
No, it's not here. It's not here.
You found them, man.
It's tricky. Members of the committee, to remind you that there is pizza and soft drinks in the hallway for committee members, should you wish to indulge. Thanks to Harlan Levy and Real Estate.
Yeah, everything there.
Okay. No, it can't be.
The amendments, as I have reviewed them, change the original bill, and these amendments, as I understand it, primarily are from the governor's office. 2912 is a bill that has been listed by the speaker as important to economic development, and we've had a lot of folks involved with this, and I think that this type of approach to studying the land use reform in Oregon is a good one. What this bill basically, what the amendments do is change the commission from 9 members to 10. It changes the appointees made by the governor from 7 to 8. It adds, it separates on the line 12. It indicates one member representing agriculture or timber industry. That's been added so that there is one from agriculture and one from timber. Also, there is a city elected official on the line 14. And then line 15, an F is added that would also make a county elected official or judge a possible member of this committee. and it changes what was line 16, which was F, changes that to G, and two public members changed to one public member. Line 24 is changed, eliminated the words economic development, and substituted would be farm and forest economy in rural areas and economic development in rural areas. That's the in regards to the missions. Other than that, I think that's what the dash three amendments. Now, do we, Mr. Administrator, do we need to take all three amendments or just...
Looks like we need all three.
I think we have to. Except dash one, two, and threes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they are separate and distinct, and there's some overlap. If you would give me about, I'd say, 2 minutes, I would be able to tell you which ones and how many that the committee needs to move in if they want to move them in.
Okay, committee will stand. Well, that will give the committee an excellent mm-hmm. opportunity to sample pizza if mm-hmm. they wish. The committee will stand at ease for until 6:30.
That's a 2 minute.
Committee back to order on House Bill 2912. Committee Administrator has indicated that it is best to move the dash 1, 2, and 3s into the bill. Elsie will then put the all the dashes together into a dash 4, and we'll bring it back on Thursday and take the final vote on Thursday on 2912. So the chair would look for a motion to move the dashes into dash 1, 2, and 3 into House Bill 2912.
So move.
Oh, that was good.
Move the dashes into 1, 2, and 3 in House Bill 2112.
Representative Zahner has moved dash 1, 2, and 3 amendments into House Bill 2912. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Words right out of my mouth.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Excuse.
Representative Greenland.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Excuse.
Representative Ackerman.
Excuse.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Girard.
And the chair votes aye. The dash 1, 2, and 3 amendments are therefore moved into House Bill 2912, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2912. And we will open a work session on... Dave, do you want to go home early? Well, we can do that fairly quickly here. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2644.
How we did this one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave Barrows, representing Chemical Waste Management. With me is Mr. Bob Danko of the Department of Environmental Quality.
Dave, hang on just a second. We'll let the administrator review with the committee the bills and camp.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2644, we heard the first time on 20th of March. It extends temporary schedule for monthly hazardous waste management fees to January 1, 2006, repealing the temporary fees on January 2, 2006. It declares an emergency effective on July 1, 2003. Mr. Chair, members of the committees, the issues you discussed before was tax and fee history, what the permanent law was, the criticality of the tax or fee, competition with Idaho recyclers and Idaho rates. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this measure does have a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Ways and Means. Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Barrows, you may now proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are dash 1 amendments, and I reference these when Mr. Danko and I appeared before you last month, that we were working on these, and they are now before you. The initial bill, original bill, just moved the sunset 2 years, which we've been doing every 2 years for 6 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. And then we make adjustments as we need to, and that's what the dash 1 amendments are. My belief is the department will say that they are in support of these amendments, so I don't believe there's anybody that has any concern about them. Except, I have to tell you, Mr. Chairman, our attorney has been working with legislative counsel as recently as this morning in discussions. The language that we believed would come forward was going to be slightly different. This is close enough, Mr. Chairman. And if, in fact, we are concerned about the fact that lines 9 through 13 may be a little ambiguous.
Mr. Chair, we don't have those.
I don't have 26.
No.
Didn't we also provide
2644-1s?
No. We don't have them.
Oh. Chair has.
Chair got a bundle?
Mr. Chair, we'll run and make copies of those real quick.
Okay.
So I'll talk slower.
Can you tap dance or sing or anything, Dave?
Way down.
Okay. No, never mind.
The intent, Mr. Chairman, of the dash 1 amendments is to make the large cleanup projects, the fees that are collected for the state, structured in a way that makes us competitive in the Middle West, frankly, so that we can expand our ability to bring some of this cleanup waste. And also, there are a number of large entities within this region that have found it cheaper to maintain their waste on site in effect, manage it on their own site, to kind of cap it, is what they do. And all of us, I think, agree that it's probably not the best way to manage this waste material. It should be put into a certified, licensed, and approved facility. And we believe these fees will help accomplish that goal. This bill must, as I indicated to the committee before, this bill must pass, Mr. Goodman, or the facility will close on December 30th, because it would revert all the fees to $30 a ton, and we would be totally uncompetitive with all the other, not all the others, there's only two others in this region, but the other facilities that also take hazardous waste into their operations.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, the first section, the subsection B, and the third lines 2 through 8 are just a reiteration. I didn't even go to drink. A reiteration of existing language. It's found in the current law. Lines 9 through 12 are the new pieces, and lines 14 through 17 are also new, and we're supportive of those. The only issue is some clarification that's needed in lines 9 through 12.
Hang on a second.
Any questions of Mr. Barrows?
Representative
Greenlee?
They look pretty straightforward.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, the agreement that we came to with the Department of Environmental Quality was that if we were able to obtain a contract with somebody that had, as an example, if you look at line 12, let's say they had 30,000 tons of material and they were going to dispose of it at the facility. All of the tax on the entire 30,000 tons would be $2.50. It could be read, Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlee, it could be read that the first 2,500 tons of that 30,000 ton job would be at $20. The next 10,000 tons would be at $10, etc. Could be read that way. This is new language. Our attorney was a little surprised to see it this way. He's not positive that he's that anxious about it, but I just want to notify the committee that we may, down in Ways and Means or wherever this bill is further discussed, may ask for some slightly clarifying language. And the department has agreed that that makes sense, if in fact it gives people heartburn. But that the intent is that if you come in at any one of these levels, the fee, use the simple example, the 30,000 ton, it's all at $250.
Mr. Danko?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Danko representing the Department of Environmental Quality, and I have nothing to add. I agree with what Dave said. We have an agreement on this language. It may need tweaking.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I move that the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2644 be adopted into the bill.
Representative Richardson moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2644. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Greenwood.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Excused.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Garrard.
Chair votes aye. The Dash 1 amendments are accepted to House Bill 2644. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2644, as amended, be referred to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Richardson has moved House Bill 2644 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Greenlight.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Excused.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Gerard.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2644, as amended, is moved to Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 2644. And open a work committee. We will not tonight be hearing 2909 or House Bill 2911. Both of those bills still have amendments that are pending at this point. So we will move to House Bill 3013. And Mr. Administrator.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3013, which was heard on the 10th, authorizes issuance of permit for mining from resource site. Yeah, I messed that up on the last time, too.
I noticed.
Not included in the inventory acknowledging the comprehensive plan. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do have dash one amendments before us, and they add the requirement for issuing a permit for mining of aggregate and defines a mining area, Mr. Chair.
Okay, do we have anyone that wishes to make a statement on House Bill 3013? Well, let's see. Let's see. I'll race up here and see who gets there first. No, that would not be good. I think Frank. And hey, you three are left, so you're it. Good morning. Good evening, Bob. Committee, you remember that Representative Morgan spoke to the committee and issued a statement on this bill in the previous hearing on March, whenever we did it. Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you for coming tonight. We'll start with this gentleman.
Thank you, Chairman Gerard and members of the committee. My name is Mike Crennan, 18 Royal Oaks, Roseburg, Oregon, 97470. I'm the Vice President and General Manager of Roseburg Paving and Beaver State Sand and Gravel. I'm thankful for the opportunity to come back up here again tonight to testify in support of House Bill 3013. Beaver State Sand and Gravel and Roseburg Paving Company are divisions of LTM Incorporated. We've been in business in Roseburg for over 50 years, and we are the industry leader in our area. And our company is also a leader in the community, supporting and contributing to a number of civic and charitable activities. Our company is one of the largest employers in our community, employing a workforce of approximately 200 people during the construction season. I'd like to give you a little history behind House Bill 3013. This bill stems from our company's unsuccessful attempt to permit our Brazina property for mining. We have now been turned down at three levels, the county, at LUBA, and the Court of Appeals. Our company first applied for a permit for this property in 1999 and then reactivated our application in the fall of 2001. We sought listing for this property on the county's inventory of non-significant resources, and then plan to apply for a conditional use permit to mine the gravel from our property. Unfortunately, the courts have determined, among other things, that our approach was not valid and that it has no legal standing. They have essentially closed the door on the traditional conditional use permitting process. The Court of Appeals agreed with LUBA in deciding, among other things, that the new Goal 5 rules are not only intended to protect significant mineral resources, but they're also intended to restrict mining to those significant resources. Their decision essentially leaves no legal avenue for permitting a non-significant resource like our property. If there are serious consequences to the court's decision, which I'd like to inform the committee of, firstly, there would never be another local sand or gravel resource permitted in Douglas County. That would mean that within approximately 10 years, when all current resources are depleted, we would have to begin importing the high-quality sand and gravel that's required to produce ready-mix concrete and hot-mix asphalt from sources outside the county. This would have a significant cost increase in our basic materials. That is because construction aggregates are a relatively low-cost commodity, and a significant part of that cost is transportation of the materials. So the farther a source is from the end use, it's going to significantly impact what the cost is. If we had to import construction aggregates today, say from Lane County to Douglas County, it would at least double the cost of the aggregates. It would add approximately 25 to 30% to the cost of ready mix concrete and hot mix asphalt, and it would result in the loss of local jobs as the mining and production of these aggregates would take place outside of our county. If you will, imagine the adverse impact that cost increases of this magnitude in basic materials will have on state and local and city governments as the price tag for their public works projects begins to skyrocket. I clipped out an article from Friday's paper in Roseburg entitled County Bridge Problems Near Crisis Point. And I'd just like to quote a couple of things out of this article. I think this is common knowledge around the state. Douglas County and the Department of Transportation are facing a major crisis in interstate freeways and highways as weak bridges threaten to create local business losses. More than 100 weakening bridges south of Eugene and hundreds more in the rest of Oregon need to be replaced. Road restrictions are expected or already in place in many locations. The result will likely be higher transportation costs for business and consumers, officials say. And then later in the article, so a spokesman for Herbert Lumber says, if they are going to change our ability to haul logs across those bridges, it's going to drastically impact the ability of Douglas County mills to operate. Further on in the article, it says, this is bad news for fuel transporters and shippers of chemicals, farm products, and wood products, which tend to be weight intensive, according to ODOT statistics. Weight restrictions would mean higher costs for anything that is transported. The problem may cost the wood products industry and other transportation-dependent businesses in Oregon an estimated $122 billion by the year 2025, unless the state takes an affordable first step of $4.7 billion over the next 10 years, according to ODOT. Imagine what that $4.7 billion could become if there are not local sources for basic materials such as sand and gravel. Similarly, there will be an adverse impact on homeowners and private businesses as they contemplate new construction projects. The consequences of this decision may even discourage new business and industries from locating into our area, as they could very well find lower cost places to build new facilities. Why do I predict these dire consequences of the court's decision? Firstly, I want to point out there are only two options for producing ready-mix concrete and hot-mix asphalt in Douglas County. One is we mine sand.
Excuse me, but this is an evening session. We're trying to abbreviate in a work session, so I'm going to have to ask you to, if you will, please conclude.
All right, yes, sir. I'd like to just say that if our only options are to mine what Goal 5 would define as non-significant resources locally or import from out of the county. I've already mentioned what the cost impact of importing from outside of the county would have. The site we've tried to permit is very typical of sites we could find in Douglas County. It has good topsoil over shallow sand and gravel deposits. It's not possible to find a better site in our area. And to my knowledge, there are no sites in our area that would qualify as Goal 5 significant resources. It's also not an option to use quarry rock to make concrete or asphalt. The quarry rock in our area is marine basalt, which does not meet the stringent rock quality requirements by ODOT or federal highways. Only alluvial sand and gravels will meet those requirements. In closing, I'd like to thank the chairman and the committee for this opportunity to testify. I want to emphasize that our company is in a desperate situation. We have no other options. I hope that I've been able to demonstrate the importance to our company, our community, and to the economy of having a local sources of high-quality aggregate materials. House Bill 3013 will restore the traditional conditional use permit process, and it will grant authority to local governments to determine where, when, and under what conditions local materials may be mined. We would appreciate your vote in support of House Bill 3013.
Thank you. How long testimony do you have, sir?
Probably 2 minutes, 3 minutes.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Frank Parisi. I'm at 1630 Southwest Morrison in Portland, and I'm the lawyer who lost the case in the Court of Appeals. Let me just quote you the last sentence of the court's decision. LUBA did not err in determining that non-significant aggregate sites are not eligible for a conditional use permit under ORS 215-298. What that does is it throws out 15 years of DLCD and county planning. There are hundreds and hundreds of non-significant sites that have gotten conditional use permits. In this site, this particular case, we never even got to a hearing to discuss whether the site could or couldn't be permitted under a conditional use process because the county voted not to put it on the inventory, and when we got to LUBA, LUBA said the whole process is not available. So we've never had the debate. And I'm not a big fan of conditional use processes for these kind of sites, because our track record is not particularly good. We tend to lose those cases. But I do think that in the interests of the state, we at least ought to have the opportunity to try. And so that's what this bill does, is it basically restores the situation to the way it was before this court decision. And I think if we don't pass something like this, we're going to have two consequences. One, we'll never get another small site approved because there's no way to get it approved. And the second thing is, and this is a little more speculative, is there are hundreds and hundreds of sites out there now that are approved as conditional uses. I don't know what's going to happen to those. Every county can now decide that the permits may or may not be valid. And our perspective on this is, why put people through this? You could fix this if you could come up with a bill that would validate these sites and would allow future sites to be permitted. And that's really what the bill is addressing. That's my testimony.
Mr. Rindy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I'm here in support of House Bill 3013, and not because of a particular site, but because this process, the conditional use process, has been available for, I think, at least a couple of decades. And many of the aggregate sites outside of the valley were approved under this process. When LCDC adopted a major update of the Goal 5 rules in 1996, they did so with the understanding that there would be two paths available for aggregate resources. First path is the conditional use process that's the subject of this case today. The second path that LCDC worked on in 96 was intended for large sites, for very significant sites. It's a process that provides a lot of protection for aggregate sites once one has gone through it, but it is not was not designed to be available for all sites, and certainly for the many small sites in remote areas around the state. There are approximately 700 sites that ODOT owns and operates. A large number of these have been already approved under the conditional use process. And I think those sites are in jeopardy at this point because it does appear that the effect of the Beaver State case could be even retroactive. More importantly, there are a variety of materials such as sand and pumice which are mined and are used for a variety of purposes and which are not even covered under the Goal 5 process. In other words, there is no process for approving those kinds of mines. So for all of those reasons, we are advocating that you adopt this bill. It is intended to put the processes back the way they were prior to this case and in the manner that they were at the time LCDC adopted Goal 5 amendments in 1996.
Any questions of our three panelists?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, it's not clear to me what limits there would be if this bill were to pass in this form. I mean, where would you not be able to get a permit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, the conditional use process is probably different in every county. Since there really are no limits on that process, the kinds of standards that a county adopts to regulate mineral aggregate not under Goal 5, but under the conditional use process, in my view, are probably unlimited. In other words, counties can attach any conditions they want. And for that reason, for the large, important sites, especially near population areas, we don't advocate that this process be used. That's why we invented the Goal 5 process. It's a process that does have many limits. It's designed especially to make sure that there is at least a significant amount of aggregate at a site that's on farmland before a permit can be issued. But outside of that, you're correct, there are no limits, and I think what that really means is there's no state limits, but local limits are certainly allowed, and probably every county has taken advantage of that by adopting a unique set of standards.
Can I ask one more?
Follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, I guess, would be for Mr. Parisi. Was that Court of Appeals decision appealed to the Supreme Court?
No.
Is there not any grounds for appealing it?
Well, I don't think there is. I mean, I suppose theoretically there are grounds, but the Supreme Court only takes less than 10% of the cases, and we and DLCD lost on every ground. So in my view, it would be a waste of time. I mean, that's a judgment call. But
what was the name of the court case?
It's Beaver State Sand and Gravel versus Douglas County, Austin, and DLC and the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And the court number is A119715.
Representative Greenlee.
Bob, I wonder if perhaps you could tell us a little bit about what a major, is that the term, huh? I mean, apparently the Beaver State Sand and Gravel was an 80-acre permit on the Umpqua River. That sounds major to me, but is it just because I don't understand?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, again, I'm not up here to advocate for any particular site, but I believe that it's theoretically possible that that is large enough and could be significant. Our concern is with the precedent of this case, which takes away this opportunity for every single other site except the Goal 5 process.
If I could just follow briefly.
Well,
but We're talking about non-significant, and I know I've heard from ODOT as well about worrying about losing what are non-significant sites, and I'm just trying to figure out what the difference between a significant site and a non-significant, because I would have guessed 80 acres is pretty significant.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I'll take a crack at that. The Goal 5 process began back in 1981 by setting a standard that local governments should be protecting significant resources, and that term has stayed in the process for a long time. What LCDC attempted to do in 96 was to define significant, and they did so by using some standards that ODOT has been using for years at Rate Rock, and by coming up with a minimum volume or size of a site that you would have to have before it's quote significant. Once you cross that threshold, then you're able to use the Goal 5 process. Well, in designing that standard, it was certainly understood by LCDC that there were a large number of sites that were less, that wouldn't meet it, and the commission did not intend to prevent those sites from being mined. Indeed, that's the bulk of aggregate sites probably statewide. The understanding was that there was a second path available and that LCDC wasn't trying to design or muck around in that process. They were trying to get a handle on the larger sites. It's true, any size site could attempt to use the conditional use process, but as you do get into the larger sites, you're more likely to have controversy, and it's my understanding that probably most of the sites that use the conditional use process use it because there is no controversy. It's very easy to lose at the local level on the conditional use process because, indeed, as I mentioned, counties can have any kind of conditions they want on it. But nevertheless, it's used quite often because there are a large number of sites that are small enough or remote enough that there won't be controversy. And I think that's part of why we are here advocating for this bill. We think that opportunity still does need to be available. There are going to be many sites that simply aren't appealed and don't cause that kind of controversy. And if they do cause that kind of controversy, and if, especially if they're large like this one, they would have the Goal 5 process available.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes. Is it theoretically possible for the local governing board in the conditional use process to incorporate standards or goals which would be consistent with Goal 5?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I'd have to think about that. I don't know that I'm prepared to give an answer. I think local governments could design a process that had some of the features, that is a minimum amount of material and maybe some other kinds of features about conflicts, and it could look like the Goal 5 process, but I'm not sure what would happen if that process ended up having the same standards. I don't know if that would be legal or not. But you certainly could design something that looked a lot like it. The Goal 5 process is basically intended to make sure you have a certain size that's large enough, because what ultimately happens under that process is the local government then is required not only to authorize that mining, but to protect the site from future development. So there would be setbacks to properties that surround a mine under the Goal 5 process. That's quite a major step to make, and is not something that I think local government takes lightly, and very likely they wouldn't design a process with that in it for smaller sites that use this conditional use process.
Thank you. Seeing no more further questions, thank you, gentlemen, very much. I know we have Department of Transportation here. Anyone else? Please come up. We'll take the middle section, and then we'll take you three, gentlemen. And if you will, hold your comments as briefly as you can, but be concise. And persuasive.
Chair Garrard, members of the committee, good evening. Doug Tindall, State Maintenance Engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. My comments will be exceedingly brief. You've heard the issues that this bill will resolve for us on the construction side by reducing the cost of construction. You've heard that we have many sites around the state that are ours tend to be very small sites on the maintenance side. that we'd like to keep using. I just want to emphasize one thing that Mr. Rindy brought out, that, and that is that there are sites like our, what the rock that we use for road sand cannot be considered a significant aggregate site by the quality standards that are in place under Goal 5. And so that means if we're unable to use those sanding rock sites, we're out of business in terms of winter maintenance. We're not putting down road sand anymore. So it has, in addition to higher costs of construction, higher costs of maintenance, it has a safety aspect in taking away a valuable tool from our tool chest for winter maintenance. With that, I'd be glad to take any questions.
Seeing none.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Gary Lynch. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And hopefully I can provide some information that may help here. Clearly, the eligibility for a site to be mined resides with the Land Use Authority. Most typically, that's the county. Occasionally, it's the city. The two vehicles or the two sanctioning devices are a Goal 5, go through Goal 5 process, or a CUP process. This is the way it's been done for years before the reading of this case. The nature of the industry, particularly the smaller sites, is known to be intermittent and sporadic, particularly in rural areas, whether that's eastern Oregon, southwest Oregon. Sites will remain inactive and not produce any material, but be permitted for long periods of time. We regulate a total of 900 sites statewide. Of those 900, 400 produce less than 10,000 yards a year. Many of them produce nothing every year. And you know, until the road project comes by in Vail, and then there's a pit there that reactivates, produces 50,000 yards, and then will go away for a while. Clearly, those small pits can't afford to go through the Goal 5 process. So the CUP has been a long-standing and valuable tool to provide valuable construction and road building materials for a long period of time in Oregon. We think it would be valuable to maintain that process. And again, with that, I'll entertain any questions.
I have a question.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lynch, can you tell us are we talking about like permanent facilities, or are we talking about temporary, and then what is the result of the land after we're done?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, it's a little bit of an involved question. Typically, a mine permit is given as a life of mine permit from a Dog Andy side of things. A lot of conditional use permits have a time limit to them. So that whereas a goal, if you go through the Goal 5 process, it is a life of mine process, as is the Dog Andy process. The idea of that is conservation of the resource. Rather than open up a whole bunch of little ones, as you go through the Goal 5 process, you have large excavations produce a lot of rock, but it limits impact to a central area. As you get into rural counties, due to the cost of transportation of rocks, minerals, of these types of things, then you need a lot of little dots around the area. Very often they're part of a ranch. They're another source of income for a farmer or a rancher. But it tends to be intermittent and sporadic. If there is a time limit to the conditional use permit process, then they have to go back to the Land Use Authority if necessary. If there's not a time limit with them, and I'm not an expert on how many of the sites have time to conditional use permit process, the conditional use permits that exist now have time limits with them. But I will say the vast majority of our 900 sites are sanctioned under a conditional use permit.
Follow. The second part of that was, what is the restoration at the end of the time?
Chair Garrard, Representative Richardson, the reclamation plan, again, the Land Use Authority establishes the secondary beneficial use for the mine. At that point, the Dog Andy permit comes in, and through mine regulation of the mine operation and ensuring that the reclamation plan happens, ensures that secondary beneficial use established by the Land Use Authority is implemented and is bonded to ensure that that happens.
Okay, just so I understand, the secondary reclamation use means that the property is restored back to farmland, if it was farmland before, or is it left as a pit? I mean, I don't know what you're telling me.
Chair Garrard, Representative Richardson, the secondary beneficial use is established by the county. That, it may be farmland. A lot of it's going to be affected by the type of mining, the depth of mining, and all those other things. Suffice it to say, it's the county's choice to do what that is. If they're the land use authority, if the city's the land use authority, it can be. You can return it to an industrial site. You can return it. We have a lot of our sites returned to fish and wildlife habitat. Clearly, a lot have ponds left on them. But that Gagami's role is not to ensure that second, or is to ensure simply that the secondary beneficial use chosen by the county is implemented.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Garrard, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie McLaren, staff attorney for 1000 Friends of Oregon. I will try to keep my comments very brief tonight. 1000 Friends of Oregon opposes the bill because House Bill 3013 because of its effect on farmland and farmland preservation. I want to tell you briefly what House Bill 3013 does do. First thing it does is it removes any requirement that an aggregate site be listed on any county inventory of resources. In other words, it opens up all farmland, regardless of quality, regardless of location, to the potential for mining for aggregate. And that's its effect. In so doing, House Bill 3013 allows any EFU land to be mined for aggregate, regardless of the quality or quantity of the aggregate, and regardless to its any comparative analysis to the quality of the EFU land.
Ms. McLaren, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't it give the option to the local government?
Chair Garrard, members of the committee, it allows, this goes to the county's conditional use permit, but it does not set any state requirements for what is deemed to be perhaps a balancing between the needs of aggregate and the needs of agriculture.
So let me make sure I'm interpreting what you're saying is correct. Local people don't know what they're doing. Only state people know how to do this.
Chair Garrard, no, I would not agree with that assertion. What I would say is that we have a statewide land use planning process to set forth certain floor, if you will, for what we want our standards to be, and I'm advocating for this committee to consider retaining at least the floor that previously existed. I think perhaps it will become more clear when I discuss what House Bill 3013 doesn't do. House Bill 3013 does not provide any limitations as to where mining can occur. There are no sites that are deemed too unworthy or no farmland deemed too important to protect. House Bill 3013 does not take us back to the pre-Beaver State case, as others have suggested. Under Beaver State, the issue was whether or not an aggregate site that was not listed on as a significant resource on the county's inventory could be mined under ORS 215-298. What we're doing with this bill is actually going one step further. We are not requiring, under pre-Beaver State, if you will, absent the LUBA and the Court of Appeals decisions, many people felt as though if you had your aggregate site on a county inventory, then it was subject to the conditional use permit and you could mine it. What this does is doesn't even require that these sites be identified by the county or by the local government at all. Therefore, it provides no process for citizen participation in terms of what sites are deemed to be, you know, significant or insignificant, small or large, but there's still no public process for this as this bill is drafted. So I think it goes significantly one giant step further, if you will, back from Beaver State case. I would want to just comment on a couple of issues. One, Department of Land Conservation and Development discussed the need to have two processes. One, the Goal 5 process. The other, this conditional use process. HESPA 3013, as it's drafted, as I said, really opens up this second process and does not allow really for a local determination or a separate local determination of what these aggregate sites are. Secondarily, I don't know that the existing, that the existing aggregate sites are in jeopardy. They already have approved land use permits, and I don't know that this makes them subject to that.
ODOT has already said that if this bill doesn't pass, the sand and gravel winter program will end. What's 1000 Friends of Oregon going to do to replace that program?
Chair Garrard, what we are recommending is that these sites still need to be retained, or there still needs to be a local process for identifying sites for sand, for gravel, as part of the county land use planning process. And then secondarily, basically, the two-step process. Once an applicant seeks to have those placed on a county inventory, then they would be able to go through the conditional use process. don't know if that answered your question, Chair Gerard.
It does, and it just makes me angry, so I don't want to respond at this point.
Good thinking.
Can I ask a question of the witness?
Yes, Representative Gerard.
Have you seen the Dash 1 amendments?
I believe I do have a copy of the Dash 1 amendments.
It strikes me that the Dash 1 amendments, and perhaps you can explain to me the item 2 on the Dash 1 amendments that talks about requiring anything in soil class 1 through 4 to be issued only on a site included on some inventory.
Chair Gerard, Representative Greenwich, that's the way I read the Dash 1 amendments as well. I think what it's getting at is an earlier discussion. I said we know we have aggregate sites sometimes exactly where we have farmland, and so it tries to balance those a bit. I will tell you that the policy of 1,000 Friends of Oregon with respect to this issue has been to at least for the prime unique Class 1 and Class 2 soils to limit or have some additional standards for those soils where aggregate is under.
But does the Dash 1 amendments, which seems to do that in class 1 through 4, does that make you feel more comfortable with this? I mean, whose amendments are these?
Chair Gerard, Representative Greenlick, I believe these, I don't want to speak for somebody else, but I believe these are the Oregon Farm Bureau's. They're waving behind
me. That's what Don says.
We would support, and yes, it would increase our comfort with this bill, with the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Don, your row can come up now. And again, I'll ask you to keep your comments extremely brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate that. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. With me this evening is also Mr. Bill Austin from our Land Use Advisory Committee and Mr. Randy Henderson from our Special Aggregate Advisory Committee. It's been said this evening that passage of the bill just returns the law back to where it was before this court case, and so there's no impact. We would disagree with that position. We believe there is an impact. The Goal 5 process protects our very best farmland by prohibiting mining on parcels when there are 35% or more Class 1 or Class 2 or combination thereof on soils on the site. If there is that combination, then you can't sign there. We need to protect that very best soils. It also provides it in the Willamette Valley for a quantity issue in order to again protect our very best soils. There needs to be 2 million tons of resource there before it can be mined. And outside the Willamette Valley, in order to be a significant resource, there has to be 100,000 tons in one site before it can be mined. The purpose here is to mine the best rock while destroying the least amount of the best farmland. That's what we're trying to get done here. If this bill is passed as drafted, all the protections for farmland by Goal 5 can be sidestepped and ignored. Our amendment, and I believe you have copies, Representative Greenwich referred to the Dash 1 amendments, and those are our proposal. Our amendment simply provides some protection for our best farmland by requiring that aggregate mine sites on land classes 1 through 4 be on a significant resource list, which assures that the site includes a large amount of rock and it's a high quality rock as well. Allowing non-significant sites on our best farmland is a waste of our best farmland. If you don't have a significant site, then you can use up a whole lot of good farmland in a short amount of time. I mean, if you're digging rock 10 feet deep, and that's all there is 10 foot thickness of it, and
give
you're
a minute
cover
more, Don.
100 acres. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
I'll give you 1 minute more.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you're digging a very narrow band of it, and you've got to take a whole lot of acres to do it, and it's all Class 1 soil on top, you're going to waste a lot of good farmland trying to get to a lot of rock. And so the concept was, let's go where the rock is deep, and there's a significant source, and let's contain it there. Mr. Chairman, the question about the sand and the issue. The Farm Bureau would not be opposed to an amendment to our amendments that would provide for grandfathering in the existing sites that have been cited as conditional. We're not saying that those shouldn't be. Again, our proposal says we want to make sure we protect our class 1 through 4, and beyond that, they can go ahead and wouldn't need to be on a list.
So you're okay with the bill with your as amended?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And if you wanted what we would consider to be a friendly amendment to grandfather in existing sites, then we wouldn't have a problem with that either. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm William Austin. I live at 3005 Southwest Dawson Road in Roseburg. I'm the other side of the Beaver State issue, if you will. I was born on a farm near Roseburg, and I've lived there and operated continuously in the last 55 years and more. You're being asked to overturn land use laws that have worked, or rules that have worked very well in the past, and although they're not perfect, I think it would be a mistake to throw them out completely. I came prepared with 4 pages of testimony and 6 pages of documentation, which you have in your hand, so I'm not going to read all this testimony. But as the bill was introduced, I am definitely opposed to it. I can see my farm washing right down the river. If they dig above me, I'm adjoining this property downstream. And due to the lay of the land, it's all on floodplain, and a good part of it in the floodway. And I've seen the results of erosion before when the property above me was dug on, so I know what the erosion would do. I'm speaking about my case because this is one I'm most familiar with, but consider that it could be any EFU site in Oregon.
And so do you have your written testimony for the committee?
I do. You have it in your hand, sir.
Okay. If you would, I'd appreciate if you wouldn't necessarily read it. But
no, I'm not going to read it, sir. There were a couple points that I wanted to make. One, I heard earlier that concrete cannot be made out of crushed quarry rock. In my testimony, you will see that the state of Florida has no alluvial rock. The state of Georgia has no alluvial rock. They manufacture rock, and they manufacture sand from limestone. You've also heard that they can't transport material over 30 miles. You will see in the documents that there are 37 sites out of Florida that supply Florida with rock. One of them is in Illinois, one is in Mexico, and two are in Nova Scotia. You will also see documentation in here from MDU, which is a parent company of LTM and Beaver State, that they own Umpqua River Navigation, and in their press release it says Umpqua River Navigation provides materials to their Roseburg market. Another...
Okay, sir, if you please conclude.
One other, they can transport also from Springfield to Roseburg. So I believe if you read my testimony and the supporting documents, you will see that we do have grounds for disagreement, and I would support the bill as amended with the other amendment that Don mentioned.
Thank you very much.
Chair and committee, I'm Randy Henderson. I operate Thistledown Farms on River Road, Junction City, just north of Eugene, and I've been battling a gravel site there, a Goal 5 site, with Eugene Sand and Gravel. We're about to go to the Court of Appeals with that, so I'm pretty familiar with what's been going on in my life for the last 3.5 years. And I would just say that that the gravel industry and the farming community is on a collision course. They're mutually exclusive industries. The gravel industry, every time it extracts, eliminates a certain amount of farm ground. And give it enough time, if you're farsighted enough to see that far, there's eventually going to be a very, very limited supply of Class 1, Class 2 farm soils. And this gravel pit on Bill's place down there, you're only looking at 7-10 feet of rock underneath the 13 feet of topsoil and then bedrock below that. So they're going to be taking a horrendous amount of a real resource that people, you know, fought and died to come out here 150 years ago for, the best soil in the nation, basically. And one other thing, I've heard repeatedly about, and I've heard this in my case also, that the gravel industry is going to lose jobs and on and on. It's not the amount of gravel that creates jobs, it's the demand that creates the jobs. So that rings a little bit hollow. And also the reclamation, almost invariably it's called wildlife. And that means you just let it grow up in weeds. And this can be seen repeatedly in the Eugene area. The taxpayers generally come in and reclaim these sites at their expense. The Skinner's Butte Park, Alton Baker Park, and now they're going to dump $5 million into the Delta Ponds by Valley River Center to reclaim those. So I would very much support the Farm Bureau addition to this bill.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We thank you all for testifying. Close the work session on House Bill 3013. Do you have it in written?
No.
Okay, we'll reopen the work session on House Bill 3013. I'll give you 2 minutes, sir, okay?
My name is Bob Wright. I live next to a particular site we were discussing, and some of the information you were requesting was about the size of it. The size of this site is 37 times the minimum for a significant site. It is 113 times the size of all permitted non-significant sites so far in Douglas County. The application was originally started as a significant site. About 2 years ago, it was put on hold. Montana Dakota Utilities bought Beaver State, so it is no longer a local company. They continued to process. The problem is for them that the law states, Oregon, that they are not required to put this on a non-significant list. They may. We went through all of the resource list, the what the gravel resources are currently in Douglas County. We did that at the county level. There doesn't seem to be a shortage down there. People were happy with that. The trouble with this is it is so far out of bounds of trying to do it legitimately that the county said no, they didn't want it, and the county, had they have wanted it or had they have needed it, could have simply put it on their non-significant list and issued a conditional use permit or start through that process, which they declined to do because they didn't feel that it was worth it. The original, like I said, the original application was for a significant site. This particular site, rather than having the limiting 35% class 1 and 2 soils, this particular site has 66%. It is simply the best of the best of the best. And what they're wanting you to do is throw away all of the effort that was gone into with Goal 5, and in so doing, that would give the gravel industry a blank check. Unfortunately, you're the folks that have to write it. It requires your signature to do it. But the process is in place. It was activated upon. They just simply chose not to tear up this amount of good ground for such small amount of rock. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Mr. Angstrom? Give you 2 minutes. Art, do you want to come up too?
Do you want to start, Art? This is a memorable event. OCAPA and the county sitting together, so we thought that we would come up together and provide testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm here today to support House Bill 3013. You've heard about the conditional use permit process, and that goes back basically to when we had planning in Oregon, at least for counties, that allowed quarries through conditional use permits.
Conditional use permits are viewed, they're discretionary actions. They're primarily evaluated based on land use compatibility, the adequacy of services, such as, you know, sewer, water, roads, and those kinds of things. And then the third thing that they look at is environmental considerations. Conditional use permits only deal with the site itself. And that's distinguished from the Goal 5 process, which we established a few years ago, where we not only look at the site, but we also look at the surrounding land uses. And in that process, the site is protected, and the land uses on adjacent property can also be limited so that you don't establish land uses on adjacent properties that would then conflict with the mineral aggregate operation at this point. So it's a much broader cast in terms of land use regulations than the conditional use permit process. The other thing I think that is important to note is that the Goal 5, when we look, that you're looking at the quantity and quality of material, and at least to my my knowledge at this point, for Goal 5 resource sites, you're looking at more than 2 million cubic yards of material for a Goal 5 site. Now, and at least most county ordinance say that if you've got that large of a site and also the quality is good, then it should go on your Goal 5 inventory. Smaller sites would not, but they would be still subject to the conditional use permit process, which has been going on in the county since the 1960s at this point in terms of being able to permit these. Association of Oregon Counties supports the two systems that we've had, conditional use permits and the Goal 5 inventory at this point, as ways of looking at mineral aggregate in the land use planning program and process.
Okay, thank you, Art.
Good evening. My name is Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. OCAPA represents construction and construction materials companies throughout Oregon. We have 160 members that include aggregate, asphalt, and concrete producers. And interestingly, we have farm members also. And this is an odd situation because in this particular circumstance, this decision by Beaver State, by Luba and Beaver State, affected the small operators, which tends to rely more heavily on both the small commercial operators, but also small farmers throughout the state that augment their own incomes on their own farmlands with small little sites that they have to get approvals for. In this case, what we have is a situation where the Farm Bureau is protecting farmland and not necessarily farmers, and I'm sitting here in an odd circumstance talking about the different small farmers out there that are impacted by this particular decision. There's an awful lot of misinformation and things to rebut in different testimonies that came before the committee, but I think what's important is I'm going to hit a few bullets with the chair's permission. It'll take me maybe 1 minute to do that, and then I'll conclude. And any further questions from you folks, I would love to have. There was a question about whether there was any limit on these kinds of sites. In fact, we not only have to comply with whatever conditions the local government puts on us in a conditional use process, but there are eight state agencies that are involved in making sure that we follow all the land, the state laws on mining, reclamation, pollution, all of those kinds of things. There was a question about whether some counties do use the Goal 5 process in a conditional use setting. They do use it as a template at times to help them come to a decision in a conditional use process, other than the significance criteria, which does not apply. The reclamation question, the law requires us to reclaim back to fish and wildlife habitat. We're required to reclaim back to farmland. We're required to claim back to some kind of commercial, residential, or industrial area. In fact, most of our sites we turn back into fish and wildlife habitat, and we have had fantastic success around the state in connecting up and being part of the salmon recovery program by connecting our pits and things back to the river so that the fish have off-site rearing area.
Interesting, on this particular application, the applicant intended to return the property back to farmland. I just asked him back there, and the reclamation plan in this particular situation is to turn it back to farmland, which we can do, and we do do throughout the state where the soils are such that or the aggregate layer is shallow enough that we can save the soils and put them right back on top.
It's a long minute, Rick.
That's about, I'm just going to say this.
I think you're in overtime.
The site is only going to be mined 32 acres, but this is the point of this whole bill. This is a home run in exploiting a loophole in the law. And the issue before this committee is whether you're going to allow that exploitation of that loophole to continue or you're going to close it. And all we're asking as an industry is to get us back to status quo where we were at before this decision was made. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Rick. Closing the work session on House Bill 3013. Opening a work session on House Bill 2945. Mr. Administrator?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee?
As long as we're on mining.
Hope you don't mind.
Okay, that was bad.
House Bill 2945, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, allows the State Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, better known as DOGAMI, to impose conditions on surface mining operating permits necessary to mitigate offsite effects of groundwater resources caused by removal of water from a surface mine. It exempts removal of water from a surface mine from the requirement to obtain a water right permit or water right certificate unless the water is used for a beneficial use. We did hear this on the 10th talk about surface mining current law and penalties, groundwater contamination, and beneficial use of water, Mr. Chair.
As I recall, there was no opposition to this bill. No, sir, I'm not taking your testimony.
Which one are we on? 2945.
I'm talking about the public testimony here. Did you want to speak to this bill? Thank you. I just want the testimony from this gentleman.
Mr. Lynch.
Mr. Lynch, I'm sorry, I apologize.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Gary Lynch. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industry. Briefly, this bill was worked on with Water Resources, my department, and the OCAPA, the Industry Trade Association, over the interim. This has been a long-standing issue. I think this bill does two very good things. If it's amended, the amendments are basically to add a notwithstanding clause, which lawyers tell me is another way of saying in spite of, that makes it do what we intended it to do. But the bill basically will provide us two things. It will strengthen and give us direct authority to protect groundwater resources. Currently, that is an implied authority. So it strengthens our ability to protect groundwater resources and require mitigation where necessary, and it's more direct than it currently is. The second thing it does is it streamlines an issue of mine dewatering needing a water right. And it can sound draconian at times, but what we're talking about, the two instances where this will be most effective is where in the floodplain where mining occurs, for sand and gravel resources, mining is typically done in cell fashion. In other words, you dewater one cell, put that water in another cell, mine the rock while it's dry, and then and just go around in a pattern. So the only net loss to the system from ground to groundwater in that particular instance is through evaporation, which based on this spring and a lot of the year in Oregon, we don't get a lot of, but certainly can get some in the summer. The second part of this, the second issue where you would see groundwater removed from the site would be there, and these are rare, at least does happen, is that the water would be pumped out and put into a stream. That would be controlled. The discharge of that water would be required to have an NPDES permit, but that would allow Water Resources not to issue a water right on that. Currently, both of those two situations where water is pumped from one cell to another, simply rotated around with no net loss other than evaporation, that requires a water right, and it gets hazy as to why that is necessary, and I'm not the one to speak to that as much as Water Resources is here. But we support the bill with amendments, and with that I will conclude my testimony.
And we should have some testimony on the water resource part of this.
Yes. Good evening, Chair Grard, members of the committee. Adam Sussman with the Water Resources Department. Thanks for being here so late tonight. The department supports this bill, House Bill 2945, in that what we believe it does is really streamline the regulatory process between Dagami and the water resources. We have some overlapping jurisdictions in this case where we're both trying to protect both the groundwater resource and groundwater users, and this will really clarify that process for both the agencies and the water users and the regulated community. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from our two guests? I think we addressed the amendments. I think you addressed the amendments okay in that regard. Any questions from the committee? Okay, thank you, gentlemen, very much. Representative Zahner.
Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments, that we accept the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2945.
Representative Zahner moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2945. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Greenwald.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Excuse.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Gerard.
Chair votes aye. Dash 1 amendments are accepted to House Bill 2945. Representative Zahner.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2945 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Zahner moves House Bill 2945 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Greenwald.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Excused.
Representative
Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Donner. Aye. Representative Richardson.
Aye. Chair
Gerard. Chair votes aye. Do we have a volunteer to carry this bill? Representative Richardson?
Sure.
Representative Richardson will carry. House Bill 2945, as amended, is passed with a due pass recommendation. We close the work session on House Bill 2945. And let's see. Let's open House Bill 3061. Open a work session on House Bill 3061. Mr. Administrator.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3061 authorizes the governing body of a county to designate an individual to approve a subdivision plat. Mr. Chair, we heard this on the 10th of April. It's come back with a Dash 1 amendment that adds a designated person to act in lieu of the chairperson or vice chairperson when approving subdivision plats. Mr. Chair.
I think Mr. Chandler is speak to this bill.
Good evening, John. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler with Legislative Advocates here on behalf of the Oregon Building Industry Association. After the fund in the last two bills, I was tempted to propose a conceptual amendment to apply this to aggregate sites, but I don't think I will.
It's very fortunate.
Yeah, we'll be out. We'll be here too long. This bill basically does one thing. Current law says that a subdivision plat has to be signed by a bunch of people, the county assessor, the surveyor, and either the county chair or the vice chair. What that means is, in a number of counties, people filing subdivision plats end up running all over the county looking for the chair or the vice chair, who unfortunately are not required by the same statute to stay in their office. So what this bill will do is allow the county chair or vice chair or someone else the county designates to sign a subdivision plat. Associated counties are fine with this. Washington and Clackamas counties, whose legal counsel were the ones that high-centered on the current law, are fine with it, and I commend it to you. I don't believe the soul in the world beyond those folks I just mentioned cares about this bill one way or the other, except for us and this, and we would appreciate your support.
Any questions of Mr. Chandler?
You sure we can't just pass the law to make sure they stay in their office?
Be careful.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenock, I actually mentioned to one of the county chairs in question, probably a lot easier to require him to stay put.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 3061 Dash-1 amendments be added to the bill.
Representative Richardson moves the Dash-1 amendments to House Bill 3061. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenberg.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Excuse.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Garrard.
Chair votes aye. The Dash-1 amendments to House Bill 3061 are adopted. Representative Richardson.
I move that House Bill 3061 as amended be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Richardson has moved House Bill 3061 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing Representative Ackerman.
I was wondering if the moving party would consider putting us on the consent calendar.
Friendly amendment to the motion.
Excellent idea. Representative Richardson amends his motion to indicate that House Bill 3061 as amended should be moved to the floor with a due pass on a consent calendar. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative
Greenlee. Incidentally, I objected to this in the committee this morning and ended up being a carrier of a very complicated bill. So
I will vote aye.
I learned my lesson.
Representative Doyle.
Excused.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Zonker.
Yep.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Garrard.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3061, as amended, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation and placed on the consent calendar. Committee, we're down to two remaining bills. We'll go to House Bill, let's see, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2860. Mr. Administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2860 modifies standards local government must consider when adopting exceptions to land use planning goals. It limits the rulemaking authority to Land Conservation and Development Commission related to the standards. This measure was heard on the 25th of March. We have Dash-1 amendments before us, Mr. Chair. They replace the original measure. What they do is authorize local government to adopt an exception to a statewide land use planning goal when the proposed use is prohibited or conditioned. It applies to exceptions initiated before, on, or after the effective date of this act, unless the local government has issued a final decision on the proposal, Mr. Chair.
This bill has a, according to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, there is no subsequent referral, according to my notes, to Ways and Means.
We did receive a fiscal on this, approximately $100,000. And cost to DLCD's budget.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we did. When I don't receive a subsequent referral, that does not restrict the chair or the committee from sending something to Ways and Means directly from the committee. What I would anticipate would happen with a measure like this, it doesn't have a subsequent referral. If it was passed to the floor and if the full House passed it, then it would be referred on to a Ways and Means or some type of financial committee, because the financial aspect of this measure would have to be addressed before it left the legislative branch of government, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well done. Mr. Chandler. Mr. Honeycutt and Mr. Ebert. By the way, we'd like to thank Mr. Levy and his associates for the pizza and the soda pop to the committee tonight. Thank you very much, Harlan. Good evening, gentlemen. Needless to say, make it brief.
Yeah, and don't confuse us now, Jeff.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman,
ask those two
members of the committee, John Chandler, legislative advocate. This may be a tad confusing. Let me walk through what we're trying to do with this bill, with the Dash-1 amendments. And to the point of the fiscal, we have had an extended conversation late this afternoon, and Mr. Chair, I'll have to rely on your advice here on how to proceed. We've reached agreement. I'm not asking for a conceptual amendment, but I realize you're not doing those. We've reached agreement with the department as to some language changes. There would be a Dash-2 set of amendments that I have reason to believe would significantly, if not eliminate altogether, significantly reduce the fiscal that you spoke to, and perhaps Mr. Ebert can talk about that here in a minute. what we're trying to do here is to change, as the committee administrator pointed, the standards under which an exception can be taken. And you already heard about one court case that went, got a little carried away this evening. This is another one out of Yamhill County, and I think Mr. Honeycutt can give the facts of that case if you want to hear them.
Mr. Chandler?
Yes, sir.
I think since you're talking about dash two amendments, committee does not have those dash
no.
twos.
Okay. I shouldn't interrupt the chair. My question for you, sir, is going to be, we can, I think, with the agreement of the folks here and with an acquiescence, at least for the moment, from 1,000 friends, although they are here, they can certainly stay their own. We know what we want to say in them. And the question for this committee is, given your workload and everything else, should we move the bill, fix it in the way that we've already agreed to in the Senate side, or should we take the time, fix it here, and send it? I'm very cognizant of the fact that your committee schedule is getting pretty fuddled up.
Fix it. Does the committee have any...
I think you'd rather try and fix it here.
Representative?
Yeah, I mean, my opinion is there was really significant opposition to this bill in its original form, and I'm afraid that if we just send it on, it's going to send a pretty confused message. I mean, it's one thing if it's just we're talking minor technical change, but it sounds to me, Mr. Chandler, like you're talking about a pretty substantive amendment here.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, what we'd be doing essentially is moving, and this is not exactly yet, but close enough for this conversation. The language is currently in Section 1 of the dash ones, where it says, local government may adopt exception, moving it, that language, to Section 3 of ORS 197-732. When we're doing this for one reason, the reason for the huge big fiscal is that the LCDC goals mirror the statute in this regard. So if we change the standards for an exception in the base statute, that triggers the need for the LCDC to go out and do a goal amendment to conform it, which is a much more expensive process. They have to hold 10 hearings around the state and so on. Then if we tell them what we're proposing is to move it to Section 3, same concept, and tell the LCDC, go do a rule that looks like this, that takes the fiscal essentially away, because all I have to do is implement a rule that says what the statute says. Mr. Eber has been working with us today on the language to do that, and that takes the fiscal away, basically. It takes it from a goal amendment to a rule process, which is way cheaper.
Can you put this thing together by Thursday, John?
I don't know why not. It's subject to your ability to...
Dave?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, I think that question is how fast LC can get it turned around. I'll let Mr. Chandler speak, but I think that we're in agreement on the proposed language. It's just a question of how fast LC can get it turned around.
Okay. You want to bring it back on Thursday, and if it's not here, we can decide then.
I'm fine with that.
Mr. Tucker, are you okay with all of this?
Dave. If I may, Mr. Chairman, he can certainly speak. What Mr. Tucker has... before he starts climbing over...
No, you need to start moving your lips.
Mr. Tucker hasn't seen this at all. His associate has, and I would certainly be remiss if I indicate they had not in any way agreed to it. I will now hand the end of notes to Mr. Tucker.
There you go.
We have not had the opportunity to digest this, and we, as you may recall, we strongly oppose... I'm sorry. Randy Tucker, 1,000.
We strongly oppose the bill in its original form, and so we would need some time to take a look at this, Mr. Chair.
Okay. If the committee agrees, I think we should give them to Thursday to come back with the dash twos rather than spending the time this evening at this moment. So we'll thank you all for being here and staying this late. Close the work session on House Bill 2860. And open the work session on House Bill 2905. And Representative Greenlick, you have been so patient for 4 months. Your time is here.
And I'll try to be brief. We have at least one of my constituents, who also happens to be the president of my own neighborhood association, has been here twice. If we have a representative of the city of Portland, would like also to comment. So if we may take the time together, I can move out here.
and it's longer than a couple minutes. My vote is no.
Yeah, 2 minutes.
You're not the chair.
Can you do it in 5 minutes, Mitch?
Mr. Chair, I can do it in 5 minutes.
Then proceed.
And if I have your permission to use some visual aids, it might help as well.
You do have permission.
In 1806, William Clark took a little side trip down the Willamette River and looked at what was on the west side of the Willamette River and wrote in his diary some wonderful things about the forests and the animals that were in what has now become an area known as Forest Park. That land was claimed by the United States in 1800, and in 1900, the city of Portland hired the Olmsted brothers, who had designed Central Park in New York, to come out and help us create a plan for the next 100 years in parks. And in that plan, the Olmsteds argued for a forest park. In 1948, a 3,000-acre core of what's now officially known as the 5,000-acre forest park was dedicated as a city park. What's very unusual about this city park is that I'm told there are two communities in the world that have a large mammal wildlife habitat connected to the city. One is Portland in Forest Park, and the other is Nairobi, Kenya. It really makes it quite an extraordinary resource. If I may show you this map of Forest Park, which goes about 8 miles long on the northwest side of the city. It's the green park along the river and represents 5,000 acres now and more than 30 miles of wildlife trail that go through that. This is one of Portland's number one tourist attractions. And in fact, in the discussion of in the basketball game the other day, Bill Walton was talking about his walk in Forest Park on national television to point out how important a resource this actually is. There are some problems. Oh, you can take that down, Randy. Thank you. There are some problems, as are mentioned in some testimony from the Friends of Forest Park that was distributed the other day in this otherwise idyllic scene. And what's happening as a part of this area is it's not clear how it's going to be fully developed as time goes on. And I can show you here a pristine aerial photo taken 10 years ago of an area just on the west slope of Forest Park that now looks like this, an area developed by the Island Kingdom of Nauru, which has something like 6,000 homes in it, many very fine constituents who voted for me in the last election. But nonetheless, it seems important to me to work towards creating a plan for the next 100 years for Forest Park, as our forefathers had the insight to do around the turn of the century. In order to do that, House Bill 2905 does a few things. It defines the area of influence around the park, the area in which the development would have a direct and substantial impact on the character of the park. It specifies this as an area of critical state concern, and it gives LCDC some responsibilities to create plans over the future for the development of this park. It's interesting that in the original development of the land use laws for the state of Oregon, LCDC was given authority to create areas of critical concern for the state, and it's never, for a variety of reasons, had the opportunity to do that. This would provide those first areas a truly pioneering model for an area of critical state concern, and it would keep the land out of the urban growth boundary in line with Goal 5 in the state goals. The 2905 has been simplified a great deal by the Dash 1 amendments, which you have in front of you. The Dash 1 amendments simplifies line 2 and 3 on page 1, and then takes almost everything in page 2 out of the bill to avoid some confusion.
There was a great deal of concern as we put this together with folks, with the city, with Friends of Forest Park, with the 1,000 Friends, to make sure that this bill didn't extend beyond what it needed to extend. And by eliminating that second page, we think that that helps. There was also some concern that, that this would create local exemptions from taking responsibility for the land, and I think I want to put on the record that that's clearly not the intent, that the notion is to provide LCDC with the ability to do some plans and to create some guidelines for this, and the ability of the cities and the counties to still protect the land through their permitting process in a variety of ways that they think important is still here. With that, I'll I think I haven't even used up all of my 5 minutes.
Oh, yes.
I did. It seemed like a lot shorter time because I was having so much fun. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions of Representative Greenleck?
I have one.
Representative Richardson.
Chair, Mr. Greenleck, do you have any idea of any costs that this may result in for the state of Oregon?
I think it will be... There should be no additional net cost because there's nothing specifically that's required to be done that probably can't be done in turn within the existing resources of LCDC.
Okay, final one is how does the City of Portland feel about it?
Well, we have somebody from the City of Portland here, and it might be better to ask them.
I think that'd be a good idea. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
The representative from Portland, come up. Anyone else wish to speak on this bill? Let's have you all come up. And we'll ask you to hold your comments to a maximum of 2 minutes, if you can do that, right around in there.
Thank you, Chair Garrard, members of the committee. My name is Al Burns. I'm a senior planner with the City of Portland, Oregon. I have written testimony, and to conserve your time, I will summarize the remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. We appreciate that.
We are very much in favor of recognizing the importance of Forest Park and maintaining connections from Forest Park to other habitat that makes it live and breathe. So we support the concept of the bill, but the techniques of the bill we find quite disturbing, particularly the mechanism of an area of critical state concern. LCDC has never used this provision. The reason they haven't is that it's state planning. A plausible reading of this provision is that it supersedes rather than augments city and county planning. City of Portland has done a great deal of planning for management plans for Forest Park and environmental planning in surrounding areas. So anything that we could support would have to be supplement rather than undo or replace some very fine local protections and plans that are in place now. It also delegates authority to LCDC to designate the permissible uses. Right now, the statute is two trips. One to propose a plan, a second to have legislative approval of whatever state plan it comes up with. Also, we are concerned about budget limitations and that LCDC is is an agency that's stressed to carry out its existing mission, and adding an extra function needs to be considered in the light of the overall mission of that agency. We're also have concerns that the last section of the bill upsets the priorities of lands to come into the urban growth boundary, and it would put Forest Park adjoining land last, right behind prime farmland. Now, that might be a good place to have it, but this is a bigger discussion. You've seen several bills proposing revisiting that. I think this is a decision that should be made after a bigger discussion, perhaps with the statewide look at the land use program. But I did want to say that we are honored to have the concept of the bill introduced. It correctly identifies the problems that we need to preserve critical connections to Forest Park. We can't support the bill as written now, but we would like to very much work with the committee or whoever you would want us to move forward a Forest Park bill. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Arnold Rocklin, and I'm the Vice President of the Forest Park Neighborhood Association and have been for about 13 years. But the main reason I came here was to let you know that this is something that I believe is supported by landowners and not just the property owners who would be affected. I own 15 acres of property, which is immediately adjoining Forest Park, and would undoubtedly be subject to any regulations that were adopted by LCDC pursuant to this bill. And I support it strongly. I did have a reservation on one point, which was I was concerned about whether the language would allow LCDC to preempt local regulations that were not inconsistent with LCDC. And, you know, for example, if LCDC said there should be no building on hills that are over 50% slopes, and the county says no building on slopes that are over 30% in riparian areas, that would be non-conflicting because both rules could operate. But I was afraid that this bill might preempt the local ability to more finely regulate and protect the particularly difficult areas surrounding Forest Park. But I'm satisfied from the testimony that I heard before that this bill would not be preemptive in that sense, that as other regulations which are not, you know, which are consistent with LCDC's regulations in the sense that they are not conflicting, would be okay. With that in mind, I support it. And just one other remark. Somebody left a dime here. I hope it's not an inducement to the committee to vote in any particular way. Thank you.
You may take the dime.
I will not. It has to be asked.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlee, are you open to an amendment on this bill or working with the city of Portland? The problem is we would have to have it accomplished by Thursday.
I am. I met with Mr. Burns, and I thought the amendment we had accomplished what he was suggesting, and I hadn't heard quite differently, so I am open to it, and I'd be really happy to see what's on his mind and see how we can correct it. I'm not sure what he's proposing is a minor amendment to what we have.
This is your bill. You're the sponsor of this bill. The problem is that we're up against the time thing here that unless you came to an agreement, were able to get to LC and have the amendment made in time for Thursday, then you would have to go to the speaker in order to have this bill reheard in the meeting.
The other possibility,
I was going to say maybe if it goes through, maybe change it before it gets over to the Senate.
And put it over on the Senate side. Senator Ringo on that committee is very supportive of this, and I think we could work out an amendment on the Senate side to try and deal with whatever we need.
There is the Senate companion bill, and we would be very amenable to working on the Senate side.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Ms. Johnny Cut, Mr. Riggs. We're getting formal now. So.
That's right.
The dime was meant to be there for Dave as a bribe.
Right.
Shouldn't have taken it.
It's about 10% of his budget. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Riggs, here today on behalf of Metro. I want to say that we completely agree with Representative Greenlee on the needs and the goals to protect Forest Park. All of us who have spent time in Forest Park certainly understand what an asset it is for the community. Representing Metro, we do have some concerns over the means that we are taking to accomplish this. And let me just say that Metro is in the middle of our Goal 5 process, and we have been working very closely with the City of Portland and Multnomah County on a variety of natural resource protection measures. We are not yet anywhere near being complete with those protection measures, and we believe that it will probably be another several months before we are at the point that we can make a recommendation. We are a little bit concerned with the fiscal impact in LCDC. We've been involved in the periodic review efforts and the industrial lands efforts. We've been watching the ways and means process, and I can tell you that LCDC and DLCD have had significant staff cuts already, and we think they'll have significant staff cuts in this biennium in the ways and means process. So what we would like to propose, and it may or may not be acceptable to Representative Greenlee, but if we cannot come to some sort of an agreement, or even if the bill moves, we would like to sit down with them, with our natural resource folks, and discuss how we might be able to incorporate some of his thoughts into our Goal 5 process. May not accomplish what he's trying to accomplish at this point in time, but I do want to say that we're open to that process. Thank you.
Mr. Honeycutt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt. Normally I am here on behalf of Oregonians in Action. I am not here on behalf of Oregonians in Action. I am here on behalf of my client, Dorothy English. Some of you may remember Dorothy English. She was here testifying, I think, or if you recall back, that she's one of the She's 90 years old and lives on McNamee Road, which is very near Forest Park. I had thought at the time that she came in and testified, and in all the years that I've known her, that there wasn't anything left that anybody could do to take away to devalue her property. Here's one more thing that they can do, probably the last thing. Well, I guess I won't say that anymore. This is probably, this may be one of the last things you can do to essentially take away whatever value Dorothy English has left in her property. The problem with this bill, I understand the concept, and I certainly wouldn't oppose applying it to publicly owned property, but the problem with this bill from Dorothy's perspective, although her land isn't within the definition of the area of influence, the area of influence extends beyond the definition, the actual physical description, into wildlife corridors connecting Forest Park to other substantial areas of wildlife habitat, which, since her property is very near this description, her property would presumably, and as you recall her testimony where she talked about the elk eating the flowers in her garden, and while they looked in the window at her, her land would probably fall within a wildlife corridor. So again, there are some people who you really want to help. She is one person I really want to help. This bill will make it virtually impossible for me to provide her with any type of relief ever, unless I go back to the ballot box and essentially try and override this bill via the initiative. So, with you know, I like to say, I understand where Representative Greenlee is coming from, and wouldn't object if this applied to publicly owned property, but if it applies to private property, especially property for people who I care very much about, I will certainly oppose it.
Seeing no questions, thank you, gentlemen. Representative Greenlee?
I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2905.
Representative Greenlee moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2905. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Excused.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
No.
Representative Richardson.
No.
Chair Girard.
Chair has promised Mr. Greenlee a courtesy vote on this bill. I will vote for the amendment. Chair votes aye. The dash one amendments to House Bill 2905 are approved. Representative Greenlee.
I move House Bill 2905 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Greenlee moves House Bill 2905 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Excused.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
No.
Representative Richardson.
No.
Chair Girard.
Again, I will vote against this bill on the floor, but I will give Representative Greenlee a courtesy vote out of this committee. Chair votes aye.
I would like to change mine to be the same.
Representative Richardson also changes his vote to aye.
As a courtesy
to Representative Greenlee. House Bill 2905 is moved to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation, and I would assume that Representative Greenlee will carry.
I will.
And we close the work session on House Bill 2905. And committee, I thank you. You've gone far beyond the call of duty, and we hereby adjourn the House Committee on Environment and Land Use.